So I'd like to call the talk today, Another Way. Jogyam Trungpa gives a really good description of what we generally think of still now as the two main options for spiritual path. So one is more Buddhist, and that is working with the habits and the negativities and the confusion, and not just clearing that away, but finding our way to the origin of that. So resolving the origin of the confusion, and then being left with freedom. And he says, in contrast, there's the more religious way in terms of religion with a God. And he describes that, I think, pretty well, that we start with what he says calls the richness of God, and we try to raise our consciousness to then experience the presence of God. And he says, basically, it's the same thing, because along the way, raising our consciousness to experience the presence of God, we come across our habits and our confusion, and so we work through it on the way. So it's a different emphasis, but basically we come across the same things. And as much as I really like that description and how simple it is, and how also, in a way, inclusive, it's like whatever our emphasis is, we come across the same human things. I think it's important to also talk about another way. So it's not just the possibility of starting with my problems, and then as I work with my problems, I find out the origin of the problems, and then I'm free. And it's not just starting with the starting point of something out there that's not me, that's really, really good, that I can then join. But starting with what's already going on now, but not the problem part only, and not putting so much emphasis on the problem part, and not putting so much emphasis on the problem solving part. We, of course, come across that. But starting with what's now that isn't problem. What's now that already speaks of a richness that's not out there in some divine being that's separate from me. It might also be in some divine being that's separate from me, but it's also here in every experience. And not only that, there's a kind of, yes, or 2 days ago we talked about the importance of that, the gap, the importance of things not being solid or fixed or final, and that in that openness of things as they are is how insight comes up. So experiencing the goodness of the space that's already here, experiencing the goodness of the qualities that are already here, both what is has a specific quality, some kind of form, whether subtle or more obvious, and also what isn't fixed or final or formed, but open. And not only the enjoyment of that, the enjoyment of the freedom of things as they are, the freedom that the things give us also by not being final and solid, but also what that calls out in a human being, the fact that there is openness and there is particular rich qualities in everything. There's a richness in everything, including inside and outside, that's available to us already. however many obstacles are also there, even in the obstacles themselves. And the openness, the non-finality of things, that actually those two things, the specific rich qualities in everything, and the fact that things aren't quite things, but there's openness. There's non-finality. It calls out a playfulness that has a kind of possibility to have leadership, has a possibility of pulling out wisdom already right now. It has the possibility of bringing us into a stream of transformation already now, and to enjoy that transformation. And so even though the obstacles are getting transformed, the habit energies are getting dissolved, our focus isn't on the problem solving. Our energy is with the joy and the freedom and the happiness of letting go of what's unnecessary, of being with, we talked about last time, that alignment of the well-tuned sitar stream. So even in the story of the Buddha's life, I just find it so, so interesting that even though his path was, because he grew up in a very sheltered environment that was all about pleasure, so his awakening came about through noticing that life wasn't all pleasure. So it came about through the shock of unpleasantness, like sickness and death. He suddenly saw it, and that made him interested in living differently. So what started him going into meditation was difficulty and pain and suffering that got him interested. And then the paths that he tried on the way to finding his own path were also about suffering. It was about really painful practices to the point of being ridiculous. But when he actually found his own path, it was actually what I'm trying to say today. It wasn't about working through his obstacles and finding the origin of the obstacles. His path was about when he just felt like he'd done everything that anyone else had done and he could do it better than they were doing it, and still it wasn't helping him at all. And so what? He was a really good meditator. So what? It didn't help him. And he had enough, and this is the key word today, confidence, that instead of saying, okay, I tried everything, I did it better than everyone else, it didn't help, this is the end, I stop, I kill myself or whatever, or I become a, you know, criminal or something, whatever. Like the pain of that moment could turn someone inside out in just the way that they do become violent or whatever. But there was just enough room and confidence to feel the spaciousness, even there, or especially there, not as a problem, but as stop. Maybe there's another way. That's actually the line in the text that's been passed down. Maybe that's what he really thought. Maybe it just got passed down that way. But the statement is, he thought, maybe there's another way. And then that thought, which is a great example of helpful thinking, non-problematic thinking in its right place, kind of, allowed room for another thought to come, a memory of a moment that he was at ease and for no reason felt this leadership that's joyful, that's playful, that's light, for no reason. It's just living and moving and leading somewhere more subtle rather than more superficial, for no reason. And that was very, very pleasant also. It was an experience of very, very, very pleasant ease and at home in the world. And so then the thought came, maybe that's the way. And it's also important to notice that the next thought was, or the next experience was fear. That's so pleasant. Maybe it's a trick. But there was enough aliveness there. There was also no other option. He tried everything else. And so then it wasn't maybe this is the way. It was this must be the way. and I'll go to it. And so what's come out of his life and teachings has been about focusing on the obstacles and resolving the obstacles to then discover what's left, to leave the mind and the being free, which has its beauty, and it's the right path for many people. I'm not saying it's wrong. But another way of looking at the same person's life and teachings has a really different flavor that I think is really important for us nowadays to leave room for. And I just want to point out that what I've noticed in having the privilege of hearing a lot of people in private interviews over the years and in deep friendships over the years, that the deeper intimacy, when someone is speaking of the deeper intimacy in their life, they speak of the sweetness. Not the pain, but the sweetness, seems to be the deeper intimacy. It's more often when someone's hand goes over their mouth or they can't go on. They either come to a place that they can't find words and their hand goes to their heart and their... Or they can't quite talk about that connection. So even when it's already hard enough to kind of break out the bag of suffering and admit the difficulties, I think nowadays, culturally, that is relatively so much easier. And it even has a certain way culturally nowadays. It's a kind of sense of humor. It's a kind of way of breaking the ice. It's a kind of way of making friends. It's a kind of way of getting in or being liked by saying, oh, well. So it's called self-deprecating humor. I put myself down. I show my vulnerability in a certain way because I know it's not really so vulnerable usually, because I know that we're all there. We've all been there. And even though sometimes it's like devastatingly painful to really say when you don't know that anyone else has ever been there, because it seems so painful and there's so much shame, that when we do say it, and the world doesn't end, there is a kind of sense of togetherness, companionship, that's really good. But the deeper intimacy, in my experience, is something else. That's about the sweet connection that would lead us to do something silly, embarrassing, seemingly not serious, seemingly very serious, whatever, breaking the mold. And it may just be that it's that one step closer to our deep heart to be inspired by the wonder of life rather than to be interested in living differently because it's so difficult to live this way. Do you see what I mean? Like, it gets obvious when we're in a lot of pain and there's a lot of obstacles that we want to do something different. There's got to be another way. But when it's just the kind of... Again, it's interesting. Chogyam Trungpa is the one who talks about the basic goodness in everything, whether we like it or don't like it, the basic goodness, contacting that basic goodness in any sense perception. He says, bringing down the vastness in any sense perception, whether it's something that we would think is ugly or beautiful, but either way, like, the direct contact allows the basic goodness. But there's more focus on working with the difficult, and less focus on the breathtaking basic goodness. And so then we feel even more hesitant and unsure of making our steps when we feel that wondrous, that even on a hard day. So it's not about being up all the time. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Is there any question?
Why do you think is it so sweet and so nice sometimes to talk about all this pain and like our bad things? Also with friends, I have that very often that we talk about negative things and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Like, but now I recognize, I'm like, it's so true.
So there are those few moments where it's a breakthrough for those words to come out in front of someone else and to be heard and met, and we're in it together. So that is something else. But this kind of more habitual way of using negativity to connect. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Why do you do it?
Like the book you always read the poems from the love poems from God or to God. Mm-hmm. I bought the book and I'm just so in love with it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it really, or I read a few poems to a few friends, and I don't know, I felt so ashamed about it because mm-hmm. I liked it so much.
Yeah.
And I almost felt, or I felt so in love mm-hmm. with I don't know what.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just felt so strange. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or like even the feeling of when I'm in love with someone, it, I don't know, it feels so strange. I have a problem with it. Mm. And I don't know why exactly. When. Mm. But maybe that then I'm really, really open. Mm-hmm. You know, then I'm like, yeah, then I'm different. I don't know, but it's a different openness.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, then I feel stupid or not. I don't know. Like childish or not serious. Not serious, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the negativity at least is serious, and so we have that much protection. Mm-hmm. And there's also the protection, and this, of course, to really be clear, to distinguish between when it's this, there's really a need to express something difficult, there are those times. That's different from when we're using negativity as a protection. And even, I mean, it happens sometimes. I heard about this before I gave birth, and I thought it was really weird, but it's like, in English, we have the phrase war stories. War stories means like telling, and then you think that's bad, well. So women sharing birth stories that where it didn't go, where it wasn't the beautiful lotus opening or whatever. I won't give you any details to go on there. Yeah. So it's what I'm calling it is that there's a deeper intimacy when it's the mm-hmm. sweetness that it feels childlike. Mm-hmm. And that childlike, what we mean is it's something really fresh. It means that it is, even if it's a poem that's already been published in a book for however many years, but there's the discovery is fresh for you. The openness is greater, is more. And we do tend to dismiss it as silly, embarrassing, childlike. Mm-hmm. We're not used to feeling that open and exposed. It feels exposed. And if we start to play with this other, the more playful leading edge, that's less looking for intensity and struggle as a confirmation that I'm doing well, and more at ease with how open we are, more and more at ease with the openness. And the kind of magic that can happen when there is the childlike quality leading, when we let the child lead. of course, not the childishness, but the child, that childlike openness. Then we know in our own experience how it comes, that there comes an obstacle, there comes a difficulty, there comes a hard day or a hard week or a hard year, and how still the emphasis doesn't need to be on the difficult. But the difficult is included and is also resolved. And there's just much less, relatively less, drama. And so we have to start to feel for the quality of unnecessary drama and our addiction to that.
You know, I'm really, really reminded of craniosacral work through this whole talk. So, because one of the key concepts.
Sorry, give a quick about craniosacral for anyone who doesn't know what it is.
Craniosacral is a kind of osteopathic healing work. It's very non-invasive. It works with the body as kind of fluid fields of energy, and there's no manipulation. It's working with the whole living being expressing itself as patterns that move with certain rhythms. So one of the core concepts when you get really into the deep part of craniosacral is perfect health is always present. Mm. And so the whole orientation to there being a problem, even though the person coming for a session might be experiencing suffering and a problem, as a practitioner, one of the most delightful things is to put your hands on their body and listen to how whatever is going on, the concept of problem really doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. The body is using perfect intelligence to hold whatever forces are in there perfectly. So in a way, it's a lot like what you're talking about, this mm-hmm. other way
yeah.
of just being with what is in the moment as a divine unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times in a session, I find myself just with this big smile on the verge of laughing because it's like, wow, there's no problem.
Mm.
You know, and somehow just witnessing that
yeah.
in another person's body magically frees up the problem.
Mm.
And they go, what did you do? And I go, I don't know.
Yeah. Cool. Great. And I think it's easy to hear. I can now give sort of an example of how what Ramcharan's describing, like meeting the deeper intelligence, let's say, or the way that it's also very impersonal patterns that can deal with themselves, kind of, doesn't exclude also meeting with the person what they experience as difficult, just without putting more emphasis on it as solidly difficult. And it's more like, how shall we be together with this pattern in this moment that leaves room for
exactly.
something to come out?
Room.
Yeah. So tuning into the basic goodness in Chogyam Trungpa's, ironically in his own words, tuning into the basic goodness, tuning into that, the deep intelligence, to the openness, also, did you want to say more in this moment? Okay. Also allows a really nourishing quality in our experience just now. And it's been lovely this week together to feel that that's been one of the distinguishing qualities of this retreat. So each retreat is different, and this one for me has a really nourishing quality. So there's nourishment that's happening already in the moment in kind of leaning in to the openness or leaning into the sweetness or the playfulness that can move through the openness that's there. And that being nourished already along with not having put emphasis on problem, but having put emphasis on, let's say, openness or possibility through openness, helps us just lose track of the whole machine of looking for results. So it's already nourishing now, apart from whatever fruit may come in the future. It's already good now, and that's good enough, in fact, even if next week is different, even if I'm not getting anywhere. And so it doesn't mean there's not a kind of getting anywhere, and we can even feel the movement happening and the transformation happening, but starting to just drift away from, without fighting or without any wrongness, just drifting away from this huge machine of results. Without saying there aren't results. Of course there are results. Of course there are effects of all the conditions that are going on always. There's always this mutual influence interaction. But we're not so interested in the results. We're more absorbed in the goodness, let's say. And that just allows more openness for more playfulness to come through, for more deep intelligence to have a chance to say, maybe there's another way. Maybe this is the way. This is the way. And even though the wall of fear does come up, even if you're about to be Buddha, there's still a way. Despite the fear, through the fear, with the fear, etc. So there was a question by note about my last talk when I talked about sustainability being messy. And the question is, it doesn't seem to be so messy, sustainability, with if we look at nature, how it already organizes itself. There is some organization. There are seasons, the person points out. There are seasons. There's day, there's night. The plants know how to seem to, well, they don't. Maybe they don't know, but they do grow themselves just fine all the time. But if we do consider, I have a problem with the word nature, like just calling things nature. But if we do consider a tree or a piece of grass or a human being or whatever, compared to what we would consider convenient and comfortable, which is what I was talking about last time, it helps to bring out like what this deep intelligence, how it moves and what it looks like. So there is a rhythm, and it's interesting that Rantaran brought up craniosacral with how they're tuned into the rhythms of the energy fields of the body. We can sense the rhythms in the year, we can sense the rhythms in the growth of the tree. But it's not that there is just organization, just order. It's not that there's any tree that's the same as any other tree. So convenience is about, it happened that way last time, so I could count on it happening that way this time. And there's no season that comes around. It comes around, it has a rhythm, but when it comes around, we never know, and that's part of this openness and part of the joy, part of the playfulness, we can call it. Spring, nowadays we never know, really, if spring will come, but usually, so far, it has come, mostly. But it probably very rarely has arrived on the same day. So I just spoke with friends in the United States where they started their garden, but it's also snowing. They're in the Northern Hemisphere, so they started their spring garden, and it's snowing. And so I think it's a really good question to come in to help us start to understand what this openness is, why the openness has to do something with freedom and allowing a deep intelligence to come through. and why we, when there's a response to nature as beauty, to some beauty in nature, the response isn't to complete chaos or complete organization. There's rhythm and chaos together. And that's what our response is to. There's rhythm and openness. So I'd like first if we just try to tune into that sweet point in the Buddha's life. Even if I know I've told the story so many times, I just think it's amazing that it made it through the tradition all the way to us. Because it's a really dangerous kind of point, that something sweet could be enough, something sweet that could come as a memory from his childhood, of course. That none of the sort of teachers around were teaching that. They were teaching, hold your breath till it hurts, and don't eat anything, eat one grain of rice a day. Not at a time, but per day. Serious practice. But what was actually helpful was the childlike that could come through in a moment of openness. So if we can just tune into that sweet point and how scary it can be, or let's say is, but also the way we could let it pull us through. Anyway, it's scary to leave behind our serious adultness and trust something else, even though the adultness didn't help at all, ever. I'm exaggerating a little bit. Some organizations helpful. So feeling that sweet point and how it can just pull us right through, even the wall of fear, any wall. I want to just try to briefly talk about the three lords of materialism only, mostly because I mentioned them last time and didn't get into it. If we keep that sweet point as a atmosphere. L-O-R-D. That's what they call it in the tradition, apparently. The lords, three lords of materialism. And I think that what Chögyam Trungpa means by materialism is that push to try to make something finally finished, perfect, right, okay enough, etc. to make it solid. And so all the three lords are just only about that urgency to try to get finished or get solid or... And it's just three lords of three different kinds of material that gets used. So to try to make us feel safe and solid and either perfect or right or good enough. Acceptable, not kick-outable. So the first lord is the lord of form. And that's where the focus is on our surroundings, like our house, our room, our backpack, our meals, our health, our work. So we want to protect ourselves from hard work. We want to protect ourselves from messy, dirty work. We want to just flush the toilet, you know. We don't want to have to do something with that stuff. So it's not that there's something wrong with a flush toilet, necessarily. I mean, we can go into that another day, but in some situations it's probably good to have a flush toilet. So it's not the things that we do, that we make, to make our life more convenient, comfortable, and less challenging. But it's that kind of urgency inside that we feel, that kind of pushiness, to keep trying to make the nest more comfortable, more safe, more easy. And so the encouragement is to just be free to notice when that's happening. Not to think that it never happens to you, but to notice when it's happening. Yeah? To notice when the push towards convenience or some kind of specialness or easiness, even if it's like, now I've got the perfect dry compost toilet, I don't have to deal with that horrible flush toilet. I've got this you know, that could also be the Lord of Form, because there's something pushy in me that's got to get the perfect dry compost toilet, or even an imperfect one, to feel safe, okay, acceptable, etc. And what's good about this teaching is, first of all, to be able to feel when that's going on, and then also not to focus on whether it's right or wrong to have a flush toilet or not. Yeah, but to just simply notice that unease as a flag that helps us remember this is just a pattern that we could feel a deeper intelligence that can be happy to play with. So a deeper intelligence that's not intimidated by even that kind of urgency. Which is, you know, like the survival fear. It's not a small thing we're talking about. The survival wish, or whatever, fear of death. And the same fear of death can act as the second lord, the lord of, it's called the lord of speech in Tibetan Buddhism. That doesn't mean necessarily our voice. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, that's the realm of ideas and ideals. So then, instead of bothering about the flush toilet or getting our milk delivered instead of having to go and milk the cow or whatever, the push, the urgency, the unease is around getting that the idea right, having an idea of rightness. So again, we can just, this is like an offering from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition for us to notice when we feel safe because we're part of a group who think the same way, and we feel better because we agree. So we don't have to, let's not talk too much because we'll surely get into a fight at some point. And we'd rather just feel safe than have that messy disagreement thing going on. So instead of directly living, we protect ourselves from living by living through concepts. And it's not that it really is very fun living or helpful or wise. And it could be like the best ideal in the world that everyone would have to agree with. And this is where we have a little bit of a hint again of why is it that sometimes we get caught up into conversation about the negative? There's a certain way, if I'm sharing my pain, you have to listen to me, and you have to kind of agree with me that I'm right. It's a kind of easy way to get agreement if we talk about the negative. Not always, if we're really good friends, hopefully not. But there is it is easy to go towards emotional force, blackmail. So here we can have this really correct ideology, and then we feel safe from our uncertainty and doubt. But we don't know what living is. We're not in touch with the actual living intelligence. And then the third Lord is the Lord of mind. So again, it doesn't mean what we usually mean by the word mind in the Tibetan Buddha tradition. This kind of trilogy of body, speech, and mind. Mind means more about consciousness and even spiritual practices. So it's just where we use spiritual practices to try to feel safe, good, right, okay, acceptable, not kick-outable. So it's not only through spiritual practices, it could be through like mind-altering substances, drugs. Some way of getting the consciousness into a place that we don't have to deal with the messiness of life. And so again, it's not the things themselves, the activities themselves, it's the push and the use, the manipulation of the meditation or the mind state, the drug or whatever. That again, it's not that it's not going to happen to you. This is just description of how the human being, how we find ourselves. So it's being open to notice when that happens, when that lord of mind, the lord of, so that lord, they use the word lord, it's kind of archaic sounding, so it can be easy to just not go there and try to figure out what they mean. But what it means is like this kind of lord, like I'm in charge. The dominance of the push towards trying to make me feel secure and right so that I don't have to just actually be in touch with what's going on and what is and the aliveness. Yeah, so that's why they use the word Lord. We're being dominated by the push, the pushiness. We're being dominated by the Lord. We're under that rule sometimes. And it's also really lovely if we feel back for the child and the sweet point, that it would make a lot of sense that if we just kind of try to fight back with that sort of armed lord, we're going to lose. But if we just, in a childlike way, just walk out the door, no one's really noticing because it's just such a lightness, playfulness. There's nothing sticky. We're just out. We're out the wall of the town, you know. We're out of that rule. We're out of that reign. We're out of that dominant push. And so some of the things that happen when we allow the childlike just walking out the walled city, the wall of fear, basically. So one is that there's a sense of working with the rhythm and the chaos instead of continually coming up the wrong way against both. Spring again? Oh my God, gotta get busy growing. I was just finally accepting the stillness of winter. God. Or like the chaos part, that we're in tune with both of those, because that's what the childlike quality is really, that leaving room, leaving the openness, when we leave room, what happens? What kind of movement happens that's not already fixed on a certain direction or security or idea or state of mind. And what that looks like, again, Shogyam Trungpa's word I like is improvising. He calls it improvising. And it's not improvising in a superficial or tricky way. It's not another lord in disguise. The king didn't come out of the walled city dressed up as a jester or a jester or a minstrel and trying to. But there's a way that thought, so again, I'm so glad to find some lines from Shogyam Trungpa that I either never came across before, it never struck me in the same way before, but it's really rare to find teachings on this because there's usually the focus on the negative or the focus on the God. So he talks about as we really get in touch with what's going on and allow the deeper intelligence to be more leading the way or having room So it's such a different kind of leadership that it doesn't feel like leadership because we don't know where we're going. That's the improvising. We don't need to know where we're going. We don't need to know how we're going to go or where.
Excuse me? Yeah. Improvising.
So improvising, good. Improvising, well, it is that, where I don't know where I'm going or how. But in an easy example is with music. There would be music where I play the notes that are on the paper, and then there would be music where maybe I don't know what I'm going to play. So each note just comes. So that's improvising.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, sometimes it's a matter of accent. Thanks. So there's a beautiful way of being really in touch with the material of what's happening, even if that's really subtle energy fields like Ram Charan was describing. And being in touch with it not as problem, but as aliveness, as with a living quality. Not aiming it towards security or a certain end point. But there is a definite in-touchness that allows the improvising to happen, to come. And so then what comes to our notice is also not planned or fixed according to a certain logic. It comes to our notice out of the situation itself. It comes to our notice because of its own importance.
A perfect craniosacral term for
is
the inherent treatment plan.
Cool.
Get it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Inherent treatment plan. So it's coming by itself.
The intelligence,
but it has its own.
Has it all planned out. All you have to do is show up and listen.
Yeah. So they also call this emergence now in other fields. It's something that, as if, you know, when you look back, it would have been a really good plan. it has a wholeness and a beauty and an integrity to how things went. But the very fact of not trying to get it to get there is what allows that integrity. So just like a tree grows, it couldn't have known in advance or planned or tried to get to be like that tree with those spots. But exactly the way it is has its integrity and can speak to us. There's communication as possible. Inherent treatment plan.
I feel like in India it's so obvious. You really can see it everywhere. It's amazing. Whenever I arrived at the airport in Varanasi, the taxi driver, I don't know why, but he had to stop at the superhighway. And he was like, excuse me, ma'am, there is a problem, but it's no problem. So I just thought, it's so great, you know? So we stopped there for like 10, 15 minutes, and I had no idea what was going on, but this would never happen in your art.
Mm-hmm.
At least in Austria, and I don't think in Germany either. You know, everything has its way there, mm-hmm. and it's very, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in India, what I learned here so much is that there is no problem, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything works somehow, and if there's a power cut again, that's the way it is, you know. It's not a big deal, so we cannot take a hot shower, you know.
Yeah.
But back home, it would be such a big deal, you know. Yeah. You pay for the hotels, you have to have warm water, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that unownability mm-hmm. thing. I don't want to go so far as to say there's no problem.
But, yeah.
You know, like we mm-hmm. are free with our own experience to feel that or not, but. In the childlike movement, Chogyam Trungpa describes what thought is like, and he said thought is like confirmation of basic sanity. So instead of like an expression of neurosis or paranoia or whatever problem, what's left of thought is confirmation of basic sanity. And I don't want to limit this statement to one thing, but I do want to give one example of how we experience that, I think. And that is when where there is openness, maybe by chance or by practice, training, whatever, by both. There is openness. There is something in emergence. There's something going on. There's some sense of a wider intelligence, a childlike movement happening, the inherent treatment plan that we don't need to know about. And something comes to our notice and is received as okay. And a response can come to that. And it wouldn't be like necessarily what we're supposed to be paying attention to. It could be outside of the rules of the situation. It could be within the rules of the situation. And it can be in the same way, like in Buddha's sweet point, where the thought comes, maybe there's another way. And then the memory comes of what that way might be. And then the thought comes, this must be the way. It's a deeply intelligent thinking that's very open. It didn't know where it was going from one to the other. And that's why it's sweet and why it's a turning point. Complete turnaround. So maybe that's why they call it turning of the wheel when they talk about teachings. And then Chogyam Trungpa also talks about emotions. When we meet the basic quality, we kind of harvest the basic quality of any emotion, of any mind state. Instead of getting into a fight with it or whatever, we harvest and are left with the richness, the nourishing quality of that experience. And so he says what's left with emotions is energy for our practice. It becomes like the power for our practice. I find that really beautiful, like ridiculously beautiful statement that people don't say this. It's so interesting. And then, so one thing that allows, it's another statement that's, now we've brought it in several times, thanks to Ramcharan's beautiful craniosacral examples, metaphors.
I can bring in another one on this exact point.
Okay, let me get this one out. And then we'll go for that. Is that when we're less into abiding by the rules and more into abiding with the childlike that comes through the openness. There's this great freedom, and it sounds like it's not important, but it's one of the more important freedoms that one, a different healer from a different tradition, from Ramcharan, said to me one time, don't fix what's not broken. And that can apply in so many ways. But one way is where we think we are obviously broken. And everyone can surely see how broken we are. And so we've got to eventually get around to fixing that now or later. Or else, kind of. And another way to say something similar, like it's a sister, a parallel, overlapping, phenomenon that happens, is that we don't need to, again, it's Chogyam Trungpa reminding us, as we start to get a feel for this, that this has been our experience sometimes, it might be another way. Even if we get scared, it might be another way. We don't need to gulp it all down right now. So yeah, it's water that we can drink. It's really good. There is that nourishing quality. And exactly for that reason, there's no need to try to eat it all right now. There's a sense that that living quality that is so nourishing. So there is the way that just simple practice like mindfulness, where we're just with our experience, there's no need to also be on top of us being with our experience. And just the fullness of that experience, the integrity of that experience, is so nourishing. And then we could think of other words than mindfulness sometimes to make that quality more clear, that that's really what we're talking about when we say mindfulness. Honesty, integrity, even the word eros, I don't even know how to say that in English anymore. An erotic quality, so not the logical thinking process, but the sweet spot where a turning can happen. Transformative turning can spontaneously happen. That's nourishing and good. And clearly we don't need to rush ahead and try to just drink it all now or eat it all now. Clearly that's part of the living quality as we meet our experience fully. So when we get hungry later, there will be that food. We don't have to eat it now and then, oops. And then there's also the nourishing quality of the openness or the non-thingness of things, the abyssness of things. There's the nourishingness of the openness. That we don't need to gulp down now either. We don't need to let that lord of mind come in and try to take it all. Yes, G?
So can you reread the quote from Trungpa about the emotions being transformed into energy for our practice?
I don't have the quote here. Oh. I mean, I could look for it. But basically, I was just giving you the gist of it. So it's when we meet the richness, the basic goodness of the emotion.
However unpleasant it might seem.
Yeah.
So in the healing tradition that I worked in, the statement that perfect health is always present, you say it to people and they say, but I can't sleep, I have no energy, my shoulder hurts, mm-hmm. I have a headache, you know, blah, blah, blah. Any one of those expressions of discomfort, when it's met with that playfulness you're talking about, that mm-hmm. openness, that inherent moment-to-moment being with, the aim and the way I talk to work it is to find what's the fulcrum, what's the balance point, mm-hmm. around what is this organized, not to look for it, but just to mm-hmm. be with it mm-hmm. until that's revealed. And when that balance shows, there's a release of forces that were bound up, that was mm. causing the discomfort, mm. and those forces then become much more subtle and free, mm-hmm. and what's freed up is health. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as unhealth.
Right.
There can be bound up health that's experienced as unpleasantness, but mm. when that's freed, it's the whole system becomes more healthy.
Yeah. And then it's tuning into the feeling of discomfort as an intelligence, a knowing that there's Absolutely. Something bound up here. But if the focus is not on, oh, I'm all bound up, but the intelligence of this is calling for some deeper intelligence.
Some presence.
More openness, more integrity, more fully meeting, whatever. Beautiful. Thank you. So I think just lastly, I would bring out again that importance of the confidence or trust. And so we have these great examples from craniosacral of the confidence that the deeper intelligence is there, the confidence that in that healing mode, it's called perfect health, or the perfect health? What was the?
The healing intelligence of the breath of life.
No, but the other statement about the inherent treatment plan.
Inherent treatment plan.
The perfect health and the inherent treatment plan. So that already there, mm-hmm. already built in. The confidence that it's already built into the situation. And then also the confidence that there is this way that it can beautifully come out and be experienced, be free or whatever. And so I would ask us all, myself included, yourself included, all of you, to start to feel for yourselves in your life, like reflecting back and just being open for that insight to pop through in moments of spaciousness coming by itself. What builds trust and confidence in that inherent childlike intelligence or possibility or freedom? A freedom that frees, a love that loves to love. And so it's partly feeling, what do I mean by trust, confidence? What does that mean to you? What am I talking about? What word would you use for that? What quality does it feel like to you? And then what has helped that come into your experience more freely, more fully? What kind of situation, what kind of practice, what kind of friendship, contact, non-contact? And to really put that at the center of our lives. Thank you for listening. May all beings be happy.